Well, hi there, it's Matthew, and welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. Let me take you back to 2014. Whew, man, that's when I was burning the candle at both ends, as they say. Of course, I had my morning radio show then, which had me up at 3:15 in the morning for work. But I was also the in-game arena announcer for the then Phoenix Coyotes, now the Arizona Coyotes. So I would drive out to the west side of the Phoenix area for the games in the late afternoon and evenings, be up until about 10, 10:30, go to bed around 11, 11:30, and wake up again at 3:15. I was tired, to say the least. But to combat it, I didn't just try to get more sleep. I was jamming the energy drinks and coffee. In fact, at the height of it, I figure I was drinking somewhere between 4 to 8 cups of coffee a day and between 2 to 3 energy drinks a day. In short, I was wrecking my gut. That led me to a naturopathic doctor, Dr. Wendy Wells, who after some blood, stools, and a bunch of questions, we figured out what we needed to do to put myself back on track. Here's tip number one, stop the energy drinks. Stop 6 cups of coffee a day. And what I learned through that journey was that we can't just give ourselves whatever we feel like all the time without expecting some sort of a ramification. And that's exactly the story of Alex Martinez, who joins us today on this episode of Learn From People Who Lived It. He had decades-long GI issues. In fact, he became patient zero for Intrinsic Medicine, which is his new company inspired to make a public health impact. We're going to talk about GI issues today. We're going to talk about IBS today. We're going to talk about all of the things surrounding the gut and what we can do to improve it. Sit back. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation, and who knows, you might even learn a couple of things from somebody who's lived it. That podcast is coming right up. First up, let me tell you about a couple of our resource partners.
You've probably heard me say this before, but most of the things that kill us are preventable, and that's exactly why I put my heart in his hands, in his care. I'm talking about Dr. Robert Todd Hurst and HealthSpan MD. He's my cardiologist because I appreciate his holistic approach to heart health. There's nothing out there like HealthSpan MD, his AFib reversal program, his CAD reversal program. Get the link on the resources page at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com.
Looking for no bullshit conversation about mental health? Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Hi, I'm Alex, 40, Washington State.
What story are you here to share today, Alex?
I'm here to share my biotech entrepreneurship story as a patient.
Yeah, that's right, because you were patient zero. Okay, who do you hope hears this?
I hope that people with chronic health issues that want to take big risks in their lives, including starting something that can help others at scale.
Oh my gosh. I am delighted for this conversation because of the fact that over the last few years, I have come to sit very well with the thought that the gut is the brain and the brain is the gut. And I'm sure you agree with this statement, Alex, but I had a doctor once upon a time put it to me like this. He said, listen, back in the early 1900s, when we were delving up the body to figure out which doctor was gonna work on which specialty, we said, you're the leg doctor and you're the heart doctor and you're the foot doctor and you're the face doctor. And because of that, we kind of grew up in this world where we saw each one of those things as separate. And it couldn't be further from the truth. As a matter of fact, the gut is the brain is the gut. It is all one, and that is the space that we're stepping into more and more and more. So what part of the world are you joining us from this morning?
Yeah, I'm in Washington State right now.
Perfect, man. Well, how do you feel about that statement that the gut is the brain?
Yeah, well, it resonates very much with me. In fact, the concept that I've been playing with is that the gut allowed the brain to evolve. Right.
Really?
Let's take it up a step further. So let's go far back to earliest life, right? To early multicellular organisms. What were they? They were worms. That was when cells decided to start working together, right? And they were an open system, right, to the water, the aqueous environment that they were in. And that's when the early symbiosis likely occurred as well. So the gut, like when you think about what is our gut, you know, and it's kind of a gory example, but imagine if you extract
get gory, I like it, get gory.
From mouth to anus.
Okay.
Pulled it out, removed all the other stuff. What does that look like? It's a worm. You have a worm there. And so when you think about it, the earliest organisms, the earliest multicellular organisms, they're worms. Early symbiosis with outside bacteria, probably the progenitors of our gut microbiome, they were there. So likely, you know, I could imagine the enteric nervous system, the nervous system in the gut, what we call our second brain, was actually the first brain. And somehow that system said, hey, let's get more complex. Mm. And eventually we'll need, you know, a higher nervous system.
Yeah. So the worm is all the intestines, our guts, it's all the stuff inside of us. Is that what you're suggesting?
Exactly. I think our, if you think about our gastrointestinal tract as a worm and everything else was that organism saying, hey, I need an exoskeleton. I need a suit. I need to be able to traverse more domains because what am I looking for? I'm looking for intake.
Fascinating. All right, man, listen. Yeah. So that's where we're going to jump into. I always like to start on this podcast with the first 10 years of people's lives, just to give us a little bit of a snapshot as to who this Alex guy is, what he grew up like. So give me the 30,000 foot view of your childhood.
Yeah. Very interesting childhood. My family is from Puerto Rican and Dominican from the South Bronx. Grew up under very adverse conditions, like definitely like a bootstrapping, you know, American dream story. So I was, my grandfather was a janitor. My father was working with him, you know, cleaning toilets basically while going to city college with my mom. He made a huge jump, right, for our family, made it to University of Pennsylvania Med School.
Okay.
Imagine that as a leap. And so I was born in Spanish Harlem.
Okay.
And it was, it definitely was a, I was a blue baby, a floppy baby. I was a baby that, my dad was a resident at the time. So you can imagine he's like working like 120 hours. He has
exhausted. Yeah.
Exhausted, broke, you know, living up there. He has a sick baby in a NICU. That was me. I think the trajectory of his practice changed because there was a pediatric neurologist that told my parents at birth that I would pretty much be a potato and would need lifelong support. And my parents were like, we're not going to label him like that. We're going to put, you know, normal birth. I had a great pediatrician who was an advocate and said, say it's all normal. Don't put him on a track. Let's see what he can do on his own. And that inspired my father who ended up running an intensive care unit after doing AIDS research at Ground Zero, wrote a chapter in the first AIDS book to never take hope away from people, right? And that's one of those things that I think carries on in, you know, what we'll talk about later in my biotech entrepreneurship journey about the responsibility there is when you're trying to create hope and having products that still require empirical evidence in order to deliver on the hope that you're trying to convey.
Yeah, because one of the things I'm thinking about is as a doctor, your job is to label things so that you can then go to work on them. At least here in Western medicine, right, where we're kind of like, I'm broke, fix it. I'm broke, fix it. And you want to label it. But you're right. When we label things like that, oftentimes we actually snatch hope right out of thin air. And now somebody's going, well, I guess I'm this. And the rest of my life will be filled with these things. And so, but that's a delicate dance for a doctor to do, isn't it?
Exactly. Instead, like now, the more I reflect on it, my folks are coming out to celebrate Lunar New Year with my family, actually at the end of this week. I think about how important that is, because you're right, you're limiting people. You're constraining them, and you're doing it from an authoritative stance, right?
So
Matthew, that is a really great point. So early on, like I, you know, that was kind of my, you know, turbulent landing into this world. My parents always worked hard to give me a better life, a better experience than they had. So we, you know, got to move to New Jersey briefly. I lived in the suburbs for a little bit while my dad finished up his residency. And then he was offered the opportunity, having been a doc at ground zero of the AIDS epidemic, to do research at NIH. And that led us to move to Maryland, where he was researching the pneumocystis pneumonia. And, you know, that was leaving my family, right? Leaving our bubble, leaving our
culture. Sure. Grandma, grandpa, aunts, uncles, friends, everybody.
Everyone. And so it was time for them to realize their childhood dream. And they've known each other since they were like 14. They live on Trinity Avenue in the Bronx. Do you know that song, Lean Back?
How, yes.
Yeah, Fat Joe talks about,
yeah.
He has he talks about some car he has parked in front of on Trinity Avenue. It was such a notorious place, right?
Right,
and
right.
So my folks, you know, my dad's going to NIH, and my mom's like, you're taking me away from the family. I want to live on a farm. I want to live in an old colonial house. And they found this like old log cabin fixer upper. And I'm like 6 years old, and they're like, Trinity Dreams Farm.
This there is, it is.
There it is. And so that was my life. Wood stove. heating myself with fire. I think that the house was wired for electricity in the 60s. So it was a very unique experience. And, you know, they're city kids. They have these professions. They have, you know, my brother and I, my brother's 14 months older than me. And we're just doing this on our own, learning it for the first time, raising cows, sheep, goats, chickens, and, you know,
which is pretty rad. I'm not going to lie. It's that sounds pretty rad. Like that experience, that hands-on experience, working with your hands, doing the work on your farm, feeding yourselves, probably gardening. Like it, I know that it seems overwhelming to some people, but I actually believe that's probably a pretty beautiful way to grow up.
It was amazing. And it set the lens that I view the world, because right. I didn't watch TV. And so I would go to the creek, and my parents would say, like, they never saw a kid that had that much focus. I actually got like a camouflage tarp early on. My grandfather's was in the military, so he gave me all his military surplus. I would literally camouflage myself and watch animals. I would like, you know, sit there for 12 hours, you know, concealed under leaves, watching ecosystems and watch different species interact. And that was just an absolute favorite thing to do.
You were primed for your profession from a young age, man. Yeah. And the other thing that's really striking about your story is we've interviewed several people who have a common thread to what you just talked about, but you also have this like survival story. You have this, well, you came out and this was the case, but you beat it. And you overcame all the obstacles, and you're completely fine and normal and all the things that people like to use. Is that in the back of your mind sometimes when like shit gets hard and you go, no. Like once upon a time, I was going to be a potato, and look at me now. Like I can do hard things, as Dr. Frank Bavakwa likes to say.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it was rooted there at a subconscious level, which makes it that much more elegant, because I did have continued, you know, challenges. You know, by the time, you know, I was, you know, so I had this wonderful childhood. I was inspired by nature. I knew the value of hard work. I had significant responsibility. I was responsible for big living things that were bigger than me, right? Responsible for, you know, keeping my family warm, But around when I was 11, and to what you're talking about, that, you know, the gut and the brain, they connect. Mental health and whole organism health are important. Around time I was 11, that's when my IBS developed. Again, I believe it corresponded with the stress of having a very non-traditional background, starting to go through puberty, starting to, you know, being in the public school system where being normal, being mainstream was more important. And that was the time when, you know, both IBS and depression reared their head for the first time.
For you personally?
For me personally. And I think, but luckily that that great point you made, that I already knew I was a survivor, that sort of subconscious survivor mentality really enabled me to push forward and compartmentalize and not let that limit me.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, let's start to jump in some deeper waters here. You're the CEO, chairman, and co-founder of Intrinsic Medicine. And like almost everybody on planet Earth, you started this because you needed it first. And that's such a cool way to go about this. I mean, I started learning from people who lived it because I needed it first. I had just gone through a serious mental health journey, and I felt the only way to make any sense out of it was to put my face in front of this microphone and record anything and everything I could in the spirit of helping people feel less alone, helping them to see that, you know, if they talk about it, they're going to feel better on the other side. And then, you know, when you're ready, come on, let's talk about it. But, you know, come on the podcast and let's let everybody know about what your journey was like. Because, you know, people are sitting there feeling lost, feeling like nothing's working, feeling broken as hell. And they don't know which way to go. They don't know which end is up sometimes. It gets so dark and so convoluted and just messy, right? Like murky waters. And so you start this Intrinsic Medicine, and I love what you put in your bio. You said, I was patient number zero. So this tells me that you have another episode later in life where, again, you're going to require some work on your body.
Yeah, absolutely. And Matthew, what you're doing is beautiful. And what got you here and what got us together here, that is beautiful. And that's really what it's
Thank
about.
You.
You know, I believe, you know, in the social baseline theory of human beings, that is about connection. And that's what makes us stronger and more resilient. And
yeah.
Provides the opportunity for growth. So just thank you for inspiring me in the middle of our discussion. So I was, you know, I have a crazy career. I was a corporate lawyer, like did all this other stuff. It's a long story, but I was working, you know, in progressively, you know, elevated roles at a biotech company focusing on, you know, RNA targeting. So like cutting edge, genetic type medicine.
Okay.
While I was there, I was, you know, helping the company deal with safety issues of its platform technology, including in late stage studies, very severe stuff. And my co-founder was also running regulatory affairs for that company at the time. So we were both managing a very challenging issue in that industry. It included a patient death, right? So that's the gravity of it. And while we were there, you know, we kept looking at each other and being like, wait, the ultimate arbitrage opportunity is let's find truly safe compounds. Like first, do no harm. Like if we ever started a company, like, and then I had been running competitive intelligence and market research for that organization. So I had this really broad lens to view the industry. And I was like, to exactly what you're talking about, everything's siloed. Everything is given a little different name. It's limited and has different people looking at it, and they don't talk to each other, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, wait a second, all chronic diseases, they might be, they're a spectrum, right? They're a spectrum of manifestations of common elements. What are they? Immune dysregulation and dysbiosis of microbiomes, of host ecologies. And so what if we could find truly safe compounds that address that? And that was my search and eval criteria that we went out to find these. And so here I am, you know, I've been raised in an environment where scarcity was always a big thing. And, you know, my my background is so weird that I didn't know doctors made money until I was in high school. And my peers are saying, why do you dress that way? Why do your parents drive those cars? And so I finally had a stable job that I was successful at. And then I made this jump. And then shortly after that, every time I ate, just severe abdominal pain and bloating. I already had background IBS. So I'd already normalized having severe IBSD. And this was something else. And I would eat, I would become incapacitated. I would literally fold on the floor, be in the fetal position.
Like cramping, gas? Like what do you mean?
It was just insane bloating. Yeah. And then it just would be like a intractable pain in my abdomen. And it got very concerning because it was extreme distension. Like I couldn't, like I had to take my pants off. Right. It was just round and it was hard.
Wow.
What
did your dad think? Well, this was going, I mean, he's a doctor. He must've had some opinions.
Exactly. So he would palpate me and he was like, you need to get worked up. And the thought process, especially given the context, hey, I just did this, just left, you know, my stable employment to do something, you know, new and stressful. Maybe it's a penetrating peptic ulcer. Right. So got worked up. And you know, my blood looked okay. So we went to imaging. And so I was getting imaged and, you know, all the time, this was rapid weight loss. So I lost about 45 pounds very rapidly, due to these acute episodes every time I ate. So every meal, So
that sucks, right? I mean, like we have to stop there. Like that sucks because you couldn't find any. And what year was this kind of taking place?
2018.
Yeah. Okay. So we were sort of in that space of, you know, the gut health was starting to bubble up and, you know, people were trying new things and trying to, you know, be selective with what they would eat, what they could eat. I actually went through a huge episode from like 2014 to 2018 with my gut health. And so it's one of the reasons that I was excited to talk to you today because I'm always curious about that. So anyways, jump back into your story. Were you getting like selective with which foods you would allow yourself to eat? Were you being like, did you narrow that down a little bit?
Yes. So, and as somebody who's been working on your own gut health journey, it was white rice and ice cream.
Wow. Okay.
I was losing weight so rapidly and all the other foods I couldn't eat. So it was white rice and ice cream was what I had to subsist on. And, you know,
so you're not lactose intolerant. That's good.
Yeah. Luckily, thankfully milk has always been there for me. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
When I needed it. Cause, I truly believe it was my mother's breast milk that restored me. When I was young, that was the only time I showed signs of life or like in vigor was breastfeeding. So we're trying to figure out what's going on here. Let's image this. And they do, I forget what imaging they did. And then all of a sudden a surgical oncologist walks in the door.
Here we go.
Right.
Here we go.
Hey, wait, I thought I had an ulcer. I thought I was going to have to change my diet, stop drinking, which of course everyone should do. And I've long since done myself. And so also a surgical oncologist said, hey, we found a mass in your abdomen connected to your intestine. Right. So all of a sudden, you know, I think I'm going through a GI journey. I'm going through a potential oncology journey. And we couldn't figure out what it was. You know, we don't have, you know, good blood-based diagnostics. They went in with a needle and were unable to get a sample. So it was acellular and they said, uh-oh, what are we going to do here? And so that was, you know, a pretty challenging time, right? You're faced with something existential. You're also trying to do something big at that time. 2018, I had also met the love of my life. My wife was my girlfriend. I knew I wanted to marry her. I proposed to her in that condition, right? And she's a doctor of physical therapy. I met her while she was in school there, and she was, you know, I was in Carlsbad, California, and she said, hey, if you want to do this thing, I want to be by my family up in the Seattle area, right?
Okay.
So move back. You have to follow me. You have to figure it out and follow me. I proposed to her, and then we started that transition. So, you know, while we were trying to figure out my health, I was moving states, right? To embark in this next chapter. And we decided, okay, the only thing we can do is we can do an explorative surgery. Let's go in to move this. We don't know what it is. Let's, you know, treat it as if it's a malignancy and go in, and let's wait till I'm settled up there to have that done. So this started in 2018. My surgery was scheduled for the summer of 2019. And a couple months before my wedding. And so we,
this is not good, man, because you're supposed to be stress-free going into something like that. And you have added a lot of stress.
Yes. There were a few things going on. And so we went in, so I went into surgery, and they found the mass, and they excised it. But what they looked at, and they found out the culprit of my pain, is a foot and a half of my small intestine. It was just so inflamed. What I was getting is I was getting a bowel obstruction with every meal, right? It just was so inflamed that literally the food could not pass it. And so they excised that portion of my bowel. They also removed a bunch of lymph nodes and other things around there, some vascularity, in the case it was a malignancy. And then they went and they sent it to, you know, pathology, figure out what it was. So ultimately, very, very blessed that it was not a malignancy. It was actually something that was called a necrotic duplication cyst. And so what it meant is that my early days, my GI tract actually was forked. So I had a dead end. I had a duplication of my GI tract.
From when you were a baby?
When I was a baby. And it probably explained some of my problems as a baby, because essentially food may have been just pooling in there. And so eventually it literally collected matter. It went necrotic. So this fork of my GI tract was like literally rotting, and then triggering a huge inflammatory cascade in my body, in that tissue.
Dude, how many babies are living with this right now? And moms and dads are going nuts because they can't figure it out, right? Like, that's what I'm thinking about right now. Because we had a baby, it just had tummy issues too. And like, and hearing you say this, I'm thinking every parent alive must be going, well, I don't know, maybe this is it. I don't know.
Yeah, forget what the occurrence of. It's fairly rare, and it's actually usually caught in infancy, and then it's corrected surgically. It's extremely rare for it to be in an adult. Like they actually thought mine was probably a desmoid tumor, and so I'm not sure, but that's a good question. I might look at that,
right?
Creating some awareness on like what those red flag symptomology looks like. Would be helpful to some people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so they go in, they take out some of your worm, what, you get put back together and it all goes away and life is good? Or you got more to the story?
There's more to the story. Imagine going into an abdominal surgery, even with all that was emerging on gut health, what do they do? They're like, hey, we got to clean out your microbiome before we cut it, right? So I'm taking, you know, polyethylene glycol, antifreeze, right, as the laxative. That's what we use. That's what's in Miralax, right? That's how you clean
what?
It. Yeah. Did you know that?
not until right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what we use to clear out the microbiome when you're going into an abdominal surgery. And then you're being dosed with both systemic antibiotics as well as receiving a course of follow-up antibiotics just to make sure, right, everything's cleaned out. And then you're discharged, and there's no speaking of how do you restore that microbiome.
Right.
in this injured gut environment. And so that was where I sort of, you know, had to, you know, chart my own path forward. But before I even got there, you know, basically they restitched parts of the tube, parts of the worm together. And so I'm like eating like the most bland of the Western diets, right? Pancakes, right? Pancakes, white rice, that's pretty much it. In about 30 days after that, I was set. I was starting to finally feel better, finally being able to walk again. I wasn't able to carry anything over 8 pounds for, you know, for weeks. And we said, we're going to celebrate by going on a trip up and camp Mount Rainier, right?
Beautiful.
So it was awesome. I was really stoked about it. I was feeling good. Started to eat some more real food. And all of a sudden, that same pain came back. And it was so bad.
So frustrating, man.
That distension, it came back. And it was so bad. I was so nauseous. I had to take all my clothes off. I couldn't have had anything. My belly was just like, felt like it was going to burst. And then my wife tried to call an ambulance and they were like, it's going to be like 45 minutes. They're like, the response times were all jacked up. And so she were like, okay, we got to get you to the car. And I just remember collapsing in the driveway. And then like my mother-in-law and her sister and, you know, my uncle just like all helping me up. And, you know, my wife, you know, drove me to an ER with just me, just like in a fetal position in the back seat. And then, you know, in the ER, you know, I'm like laying on the floor and they're like, no, you have to sit in the seat to, you know, or else we can't intake you. Right. And I'm like, so it was just brutal because I like can't sit down because my stomach is so distended. And, you know, finally, you know, got in there, you know, I would argue that they were treating me as a drug seeking patient, as a pain med seeking patient, until my father got on the phone with the doctor. My wife was like, oh, we gotta figure something out and get him pain meds. And so what it turned out is I had a stricture. So that part of my GI tract that was cut together, there's a lot of stickiness on it, right? You can imagine there's a lot of cellular remodeling going on, but they also removed those lymph nodes, those blood vessels. So there was an opportunity for it to stick. And so what happens is it's stuck. And then as it healed, of course, there's going to be fibrotic tissue, scar tissue in there. And it basically, like, imagine a kink in a hose, right?
Yeah, sure. It's what I was just thinking of.
And so lo and behold, I went in for bowel obstructions. I left with a bowel obstruction and it was completely blocked where it could have gone ischemic, which means then everything down, all the blood flow would have been gone. So then the entire thing dies, right? The worm, the bottom part of the worm dies. And so this was literally a scenario that if we had made it to that campsite and this happened here, I don't think we wouldn't be talking.
You think you would have died?
Yeah, I think I would have died. So,
oh man, were you so pissed? Like, I'm just thinking really quick. Like, you had surgery, they seemingly fixed it, and then here you are, you're trying to live your life, and then this thing comes back, and you must have just been like, "The fuck is going on, dude? Like, what do I have to do to beat this thing?"
Yeah, it definitely was challenging, right?
So, yeah, you're being nice. Go ahead.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I try to be a pretty nice person, but yeah, I was. I was pissed off because I didn't know who to blame. Right.
Right. Sure. Sure.
It's one of those things. Yeah. I don't know who to blame. And I really try to take everyone, like everyone's just trying to do their best. Right. You know, just try to be kind, try to be generous with everyone. And so like, who am I going to take it out on? A nurse? Who am I going to take it out on? The doctor that tried to be as thorough as possible. And so, you know, I'm sitting there in this unit and 5 days, no eating. And that's what enabled me to get out of there. Right. And until I finally had a bowel movement, they wouldn't discharge me. And so then, you know, that happened. And now I know like, okay, I'm dealing with this. Now I'm going to have to rebuild my gut microbiome. And I'm going to have to do it with the understanding of this dynamic. And so luckily, you know, my wife being a DPT, she's doing scar tissue mobilization, which is not fun, but it's necessary. Yeah. My abdomen. And then it was building up my diet. And that's kind of where, you know, I said, it's time to be patient zero. And that is when I started taking a supplement version of the compounds that I'm, these human milk oligosaccharides that I'm now developing as drugs to restore my microbiome, to promote healing, which I certainly did. And also to fulfill a vision I had when I left, you know, my previous job to start a therapeutics company. I imagined what kind of drugs we would have today if every CEO was required to be the first person to take their drugs. What if every CEO, it was a mandate that you had to be in the phase one safety and tolerability studies? What would the armament look like today? I bet it would look like the one we believe we should have, considering we're talking about manned missions to Mars, right? There's a huge disconnect between and the silicone-based technologies that we have today.
Dude, all right. I have a million questions swimming in my head right now. I really want to get into this idea. We said it up front. The gut is the brain is the gut. You actually think the gut came before the brain, which is a super interesting concept that I can warm up to. And I want to understand, because I'm thinking people who have come to this podcast because their gut sucks too.
Yeah.
And they're just looking for answers. Let me give you a short story. And like I mentioned, 2014, I was a morning show radio personality. And because of that, the hours were ridiculous. 3:15 in the morning was when I would wake up for work. And then I was doing some side hustle work on the side that would keep me up until about 9:30, 10:30 at night, some nights. And so at best, I was sleeping about four and a half hours a day for a few years in a row. And I was, in the meantime, slamming coffee, slamming energy drinks, slamming 5-hour energy, Red Bulls, you name it. I mean, just to get through my day, I was caffeinating like crazy. And then I ran into this problem where I just really, as you can imagine, awful, felt terrible. So I went to a naturopath and she was super wonderful. And we did all the poop and the pee and the blood and all the tests that people do. And I went on a super restrictive diet. That's why I asked you about what yours was. Mine was like cucumbers, some salad, chicken, rice, to your point. I think that was it. There was like 4 or 5 things that I ate for about 2.5 or 3 weeks. We got everything to settle down. She started pumping me with, you know, like probiotics and some adrenal gland stuff and, you know, probably some other compounds that I was taking. And eventually we landed on this idea that when I eat a potato or I eat a grain too close to each other, there's some interaction that happens with those two things where they cause me to be really uncomfortable. And, you know, like it wasn't uncommon for me to leave work, hit up Wendy's, have some French fries, and then 4 or 5 hours later, eat a meal with my family, which would be, you know, chicken and rice, steak and rice, fish and rice, something like that. And so that combination just did not work for me. It made my stomach hurt. As a result, I have almost eliminated potatoes completely from my diet. And I usually just stay on a grain diet because it's just easier for me. I like those foods more than I like potatoes anyway, so it's not that big of a stretch. But I seemingly have it under control. But just recently, last year or two, I've been really wondering about how much stress impacted that decision, you know, back in 14, 15, 16. And now that I'm not in that high stress job anymore, I'm doing things that I love every single day. I'm happier, better relationships with my wife, my kids, the people around me. I'm at a point where I'm starting to wonder and get real curious about being able to open back up my diet. Because I'm like so many people in this world, man. Like I didn't have to care about what I ate my whole life until I was like 40. And then all of a sudden it was like,
you can't eat that, you can't eat that, you can't eat that, you can't eat this. And now there are a few things that I really have to stay away from because they piss off my body so much. And so I wonder if you could help me and everybody else understand what happens when we eat food and why do certain things piss off the gut? Gluten comes to mind. It's a huge thing now to be gluten-free, which I can't eat because there's a potato starch and a rice flour in there. And so that gluten-free products wreck me. So what is it? What's happening in food and digestion where foods present issues to us? Do you understand that?
Yeah, yeah. So let me see if I can kind of walk through some just different.
Talk to me like I'm a third grader. Yeah, talk to me like I'm a third grader.
Different concepts. So there's a direct wire, right? There's a bidirectional communication, right? There's a telegram between the gut nervous system and the brain, right? It's the vagus nerve.
Yes. Oh, the vagus nerve. Yep.
Right. So it's bidirectional, and that's. And that vagus nerve even can control our fight or flight reflex, right?
Yes.
So it's communicating. And so when you're stressed out, there is a behavioral sort of profile that changes. It's like a light switch on our comprehensive behavior. It's called sickness-like behavior, right? And so you become antisocial. You don't want to be around other people. You become more fearful, more kind of reactive to sort of outside, you know, perceived threats. Your threat perception goes up. You even don't want to, you know, become lethargic, right? You want to kind of limit your movement. And as part of that, your appetite goes away as well. So we know that being, stressed out, being in a pro-inflammatory state, which stress can lead to, right? Stress, like what we call a stress, it's not just in our heads. It's actually creating oxidative stress. Oxidation,
sure.
It's rust. It's what turns steel into something brittle, oxidation, right? And so that oxidation is happening on cells. And when cells are oxidized, guess what? Our immune system doing the best job it can. Inflammation is wonderful when it happens in the right acute setting, when it's short-lived. But when it's chronically activated, the immune cells are saying, hey, I got to do my job. Let's start attacking our own cells, right? These oxidized cells. And a lot of that happens in the gut, right? 70% of the immune system is in the gut, right? The immune system's like the boot camp. The gut is like the boot camp for the immune system, right?
Okay.
And that's important because did you know that after you eat, which is called the postprandial period, inflammation always occurs? Immune cells are always going to the gut. Why? Because the gut is actually like the thin blue line between order and chaos. Because you're taking a bunch of outside molecules, including ones that have outside bacteria and microbes on them. And we're trying to take the nutrients, the building blocks to repair the body while keeping out the bad actors, right? So it literally is a skirmish line. And when you're in that stressed out environment, lo and behold, what happens? You get leaky gut.
Yeah, we've heard about that. I've heard about this leaky gut. Yeah.
Right. So the layer is already fractured. It's already a greater challenge to control it. And then if you have molecules, for example, you have a gluten sensitivity or something, the immune cells that are trying to hold that line are also recognizing, hey, wait, there's someone else here. There's a lot of threats here. And you get collateral damage, which could include damage of the tissues, within that skirmish line. So that's, one dynamic of what's going on. But the other one that I think is really important to your point about, hey, I found some foods that worked once upon a time, and sometimes it changes, or I'm feeling better here, I'm less stressed. When can I start liberalizing my diet? Because, to our earlier conversation about limitations, that limitation is going to also impact your head, your mind, how you perceive yourself, which will create background stress, right? And that'll probably offset kind of your allostatic capacity. Think about allostasis as your capacity to deal with stress, right? So that's your stress cup. And the more that's filled up, the more, you know, little things eventually can push you up to overflowing.
Such a great way to put that, man.
So, so I think one of the things that's happening with food is, and I think this is a cutting edge understanding of the gut. It's not who the bugs are. It's what they're doing, right? It's with people too. Doesn't matter what background that, what ethnicity that or nationality that person is, who they are, what gender they are, what they're doing matters, right? Whether you would say you're helpful, you're a good person, or you're a bad person, you're not helping the community, right?
Right, right.
So when you think about the foods that you're putting in, even plant-based foods, those are the substrates that, that's the feedstock that determines what the bugs do. Because all these bugs take, especially the prebiotic, the fibers there, and they metabolize them into a bunch of small molecules that are extremely bioactive. And so I think that's kind of what's deterministic. And then they cross feed off of each other, right? So someone might be producing different bioactives that maybe enable a pathogen to flourish in those conditions. So it's not who they are, it's what they're doing.
Got it. I want to ask, as we kind of wind down our hour together, oh, yeah. I have so many things I want to talk to you about. I may have to have you back, how do we improve our gut health today? Yeah. What is the Bristol stool form scale? Like, there's a couple of things that I'd like to ask you, because I want to make sure that people leave our conversation today with a few actionable items that they can do to start improving their own gut health.
Wonderful. I'm so happy. It wouldn't be an interview with me if we didn't talk about poop, right?
Good.
Yeah. And so this is the beauty of our conversation is, so, right. So, okay. So everyone understands it's not just who they are, it's what they're doing. What they're doing is largely determined by the fibers you eat. Well, lo and behold, audience, and I know we actually have some selection bias, right? Because people here are thinking about change, thinking about optimizing themselves. So you may have already taken some steps, but our dietary fiber goals are like 30 grams of fiber. Only 5% of US adults are at that goal, right?
What?
Yes. Yeah. So most people, if you do a fiber audit, right? Measure your food, right? So learn to take a food journal, quantify the amount of fiber, do an audit on that, right? So that's going to be a very empowering tool. And then you say, well, okay, so start there. And then you can leverage the Bristol stool form scale, which is anyone can look it up. It's freely available. I think the Rome Foundation always keeps it up to date, and it's a visual scale. It really.
So some poop pictures.
Some pictures of poop, right?
There it is.
I call it the poop compass, right?
Perfect.
And you can look at it every time you have a bowel movement, and you can look at sort of what that healthy stool looks like. And it's around at like the number 4-1. The way I like to think about it is my goal is no white poops, right? That's the goal. And when you have them, you feel different. You feel fantastic, right? I think in general, there was a weird paper, but it's a paper I always love to quote. You can look it up somewhere. I think all mammals, when they're having healthy poops, 12 seconds is how long it takes them to do it, right? So you have a benchmark. You know what it looks like using the Bristol stool form scale. And then if you have this food journal, you can start to, very similar to what you did, right? You go on an elimination diet, and then you start to add in different things. and you're starting to get a fiber stack. And maybe as you start stacking certain, you know, sort of food stuff that you enjoy, first and foremost, that you enjoy, you can look at your Bristol full stool form scale, but you can also log, hey, how am I feeling, right? What we need to do is we need to, I think we've already been through the sort of the quantified self, right? Everyone has all these trackers and stuff. We need to start thinking about the qualified self. How does this stuff actually make me feel?
Okay.
So as you're adding to that stack to work towards that prebiotic, that fermentable dietary fiber goal, that's going to help the good bugs do the right thing in your gut, you can also say, oh, maybe this doesn't agree with me at this point in time, right? Let me put that in a, maybe later we'll explore that. And then you move on to something else. Like, so for example, apples are like, apples and sweet potato are my staple. I would love the idea of quinoa. Doesn't work for me. And so using those two things, a food journal that includes a fiber audit and a Bristol stool form scale, you have the tools to really troubleshoot and work on optimization.
Let me ask you a question. You mentioned this word earlier, fermented. You said, and we just talked to this nutritionist on our podcast like a few days ago. And I was telling him about this potato grain thing that I did. And one of the things he said to me was, you should consider fermenting your potatoes before you eat them, because that'll get rid of a lot of that stuff that, you know, number one, peel them and then ferment them and see if that doesn't help you out with, you know, some of your issues. What do you know some thing or two about that as well?
Yeah, then that's a great recommendation, right?
It is.
Yeah, it's a great recommendation. And when we think about it, it's like fermentation has been used throughout our history because it's literally a way of externalizing good bugs doing the right thing, which enables food storage, right? Which enables civilization, which enables more complex societies, and knowing that the food will remain safe because those bacteria create an environment. They create a micro environment around that food stuff that prevents the pathogenic growth, right? Kimchi. Okay. So imagine kimchi.
So what we were talking about was kimchi.
Yeah, exactly. Kimchi, kefir, right? Kefir, yogurt. Cheeses are a form of that too, right? So it extends into animal proteins. Earliest sausages, do you know those are fermented? That's fermented meat, right? So think about what dry aging is. It's a great opportunity, right? So there are tools available in the right context at your grocery store, and then eventually you can make your own fermented food. I make my own kimchi. Sauerkraut, right? Made the old fashioned way is also a great one versus like, hey, some people can't eat cabbage, right? Raw, but you can eat kimchi or sauerkraut. So
fascinating. My cat has decided.
I saw this little tail.
I have a Sphinx cat, and the Sphinx cat is most like a monkey. They have absolutely no boundaries. They need to be around. I used to fight it on the podcast, but I've learned to absolutely stop the fighting of it because it won't go well.
Wow.
It will not go well, man.
Beautiful.
Incredible. Yeah, I know. She's a sweetheart. She is a sweetheart. No way around it. All right, good. So the fermented thing is actually a pretty good idea. And then people looking at their poop, seeing what it looks like, using this scale, figure it out, doing a fiber audit. What about all of the products that they try to push on us, you know, from prebiotics to probiotics to all of the things out there? Are there a few out there that are really worth your money, or are most of them just, you know, expensive pee, as people like to say?
Yeah, so I'm pretty much against probiotics.
Are you?
Yeah. They don't work, you know, they don't work, and you're potentially creating risk factors, right? You know, for probiotics to be made, you literally are taking bugs out of the gut, right? It's a geological time frame for them, right? It's like, it might as well be 1,000 years, like from when they're in the host. And often antibiotic resistant genes are actually incorporated into those strains, because how do you culture them in a cell culture medium without pathogens also growing, unless you're actually bombing that with antibiotics, right?
Okay.
And so guess what bacteria do? They share genes. So you put those back in your body, what happens? Wait, strange. We have this epidemic of antibiotic resistant bacteria, right? I don't think probiotics are helping us with that. Prebiotics, I think that there's a whole host of those. But what I would say is let's empower ourselves first, because if you raise the amount of fermentable fiber, amount of fibers that you're eating, both soluble and insoluble fibers, ones in your diet, you're getting a whole host of other nutrients, right? Give that to yourself first, right? Get that whole food stack first. And then if it becomes challenging, something like apple peels, an HMO supplement, like an inulin supplement, and at lower doses, you don't want to take too much inulin fibers. There has been some talk shown in some studies. So just moderation, right? Max it out on whole foods first. And if there's a gap, then, one of those could offer you something.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Man, this is such a cool space that we're headed into. And it's kind of fun that you're on the forefront of it. And, you're leading the charge. I want to let people know that, we mentioned it up front, but you can go to intrinsicmedicine.com, and this is the site. I was on it just a little bit ago, just whipping through everything and checking it all out. But when you all take off to the site, that's exactly what you're going to find. We didn't spend a whole lot of time, and so maybe we could wrap on this idea of human Mike oligosaccharides. Did I say that even remotely right? Come on.
Human milk oligosaccharides, and as it says on the website, they're our birthright, right?
So okay.
These are sugars. They're the third largest solid component of human milk. Guess what? We can't break them down for caloric energy. What do? So they are a communication system by which a mother can directly communicate with the developing somatic cells, the body's own cells, but also the symbiotes, the microbiome, and guide them on sort of a foundational homeostasis, balanced ecosystem that's going to best support the baby based on the mom's experience and what's going on in the environment. They occur in the mom's circulation starting the first trimester. They're in the fetal cord blood. They're in the amniotic fluid, right? So they're encapsulating our most vulnerable time frame. And then, of course, after a baby is born, if the mom's able to breastfeed, they're orally dosed. These are nature's drugs, and they are just magnificent biologically. And we're going to unlock the therapeutic utility for a lot of people.
Is it something that we can take later in life too? Like, I obviously we can't breastfeed on our moms when we're 30, but like, is there a version of that for adults and older kids that they can latch onto?
So that's what Intrinsic Medicine, that's our mission, is to show that infant biology carries on into late life. And right now the data looks compelling that it does.
Fascinating, man. I mean, like we've all heard, how great it is to breastfeed, but you brought up a great point. Like that's not a reality for every woman and every situation. And, if you can, great. But if you can't, how would you, like, maybe there's a mom listening to this and she's carrying a baby and she's like, oh my God, what if I can't breastfeed? Are there other ways that she can make sure that her baby gets some of the good stuff?
Great question. Look for infant formula that includes HMOs. There are some on the market. Look for one that includes 2-FL.
2-FL.
Yep. 2-FL. Okay. 2 prime fucosyl lactose. Shortened to 2-FL, it'll be on the label.
Okay.
That's the one to, if you must use formula.
Okay.
And it happens.
Yeah, for sure. All right. I think we'll probably have to schedule you back at some point, because I don't think I got halfway through some of the stuff that I wanted to talk to you about.
I'd love to come back.
And I feel like you left a lot on the table too. I feel like there's more that you could have brought to the party too. Who would be a perfect client for to come out and spend some time with you guys at Intrinsic Medicine? Is there kind of an ideal client that you've targeted?
No, I mean, right now we're a drug development company. So I'm really just focused on launching clinical studies. I'm getting ready to launch a clinical study in Parkinson's disease, right?
Fascinating.
So I'd love to talk to you more about that. And so really sign up on my website. I'm going to be providing updates. I view us as a patient solution company. We're not just a pharmaceutical company. So I'm right. also you're going to be creating content, you know, your podcast will be listed, you know, on there, and we're going to be creating our own de novo content to support people in their own patient journeys. So it's, you know, reach out, LinkedIn me, if this resonates with you, and maybe we can just think about, you know, ways to advance this and other patient solutions together.
Yeah. Love it, man. Alex, have a great day, pal.
Thank you. You too.
We have three goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn from People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn from People Who Lived It.